Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. This is Dr. Melek Ferhat Altay. I am a musician and a neuroscientist, and my research focuses on deciphering the pathomechanisms of neurodegenerative and neurodevelopmental disorders. Today, I will be your host, and we will be talking to Dr. Mark Münsterhelm about his new book, Forensic Colonialism, Genetics and the Capture of Indigenous Peoples, published by the McGill-Queen's University Press this year. Dr. Münsterhelm's research focuses on racism and ideology in genetic research on indigenous peoples. He is currently studying how several indigenous peoples in Latin America and the Pacific region have been objectified and incorporated into forensic genetic identification technologies and security-related biotechnology development. Forensic genetic technologies are popularly conceptualized and revered as important tools of justice. The research and development of these technologies, however, have been accomplished through the capture of various indigenous peoples' genetic material and the subsequent ongoing genetic servitude. In Forensic Colonialism, Mark Münsterhelm explores how controversial studies of indigenous peoples have been used to develop racializing forensic technologies. Making moral and political claims about defending the public from criminals and terrorists, international networks of scientists, police, and security agencies have developed forensic genetic technologies firmly embedded in hierarchies that target and exploit many indigenous peoples without their consent. Münsterhelm concludes that technologies produced by forensic genetics advance the biopolitical security only of privileged populations, and that this depends on imposing race-based divisions between who lives and who dies. Mark, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Right. Before we move on to discussing forensic colonialism, please could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, certainly. I teach courses including research methodology, social theory, and policing and security in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Windsor in Canada. I have a master's degree in Indigenous governance from the University of Victoria. There I wrote a master's thesis on Canada-Taiwan Aboriginal exchanges. I was looking at how these exchanges involve the use of what I term hero rescue Indigenous peoples organizing narratives to coordinate amongst themselves. And there I became interested in how government and corporate networks cooperate? You know, how do they get along and how do they organize themselves? Later, when I pursued my PhD, I did at the University of Windsor, I did a sociology dissertation on sovereignty and racism in genetic research involving Taiwan Aborigines, Maori, and other Pacific Island indigenous peoples. And there I became very interested in the sort of the central roles of scientists in organizing these international networks and also the commercialization of genetics at that time. And I was became also interested in how these scientific networks could be kind of disrupted due to external criticism and pressure over research ethics and Aboriginal rights and sovereignty violations. During my PhD, I found patents filed by a leading Taiwan health researcher named Guiying Chin of Kaohsiung Medical University. These involved over 1,500 Atayal Aborigines, and they which led to a 2010 controversy in Taiwan, national controversy, over the lack of informed consent for commercialization and other research violations. I found further patents in 2011, which led to another controversy, this involving, again, over 1,500 Atayal Aborigines in Taiwan, but also nearly 200 Solomon Islanders, which led to controversies in Taiwan and the Solomon Islands. The Taiwan and Solomon Islands at that point having diplomatic relations. So it tied in as well to Taiwan's diplomacy efforts. And so these experiences highlighted to me the effectiveness of kind of closely analyzing how prominent scientists have used indigenous people's genetic materials and data as resources in their research, and how this has routinely violated indigenous people's rights and sovereignty, and also how such analysis through public engagement could contribute to disrupting the scientific networks. So this is sort of where how I arrived in this area of research around forensic genetics.
And how did you come to writing Forensic Colonialism, and why now?
I wrote this book out of a deep concern of how, under the guise of the so-called War on Terror, powerful networks of leading scientists, European, Chinese, U.S. security agencies, as well as major genetic equipment manufacturers like Illumina and Thermo Fisher, which are based in the U.S., and Quagen, which is a Dutch-German company, were kind of pushing particularly Illumina and Thermo Fisher, were pushing and promoting forensic genetics expansion into ancestry inference and phenotype inference research. These were essentially utilizing concepts of race that had long been discredited. And so in the name of sort of public security, these networks organize themselves through a shared use of a manhunting narrative, or in which the scientists develop technologies to assist police and national security agencies in the identification of dangerous threats like murderers and terrorists. And in the name of public security, these powerful networks have expanded into ancestry inference and phenotype, phenotype meaning visible appearance. Which is very problematic because it effectively resurrects what were once discredited categories of race and portrays them as somehow scientifically valid. They use euphemisms like ancestry and phenotype, and which are fundamentally racial categorizing concepts. And this has all been done using indigenous people's genetic materials, often taken decades ago, in the 1970s even, and 1980s, in massive and systematic violations of contemporary ethics and legal norms. So, for example, like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this is a severe injustice that's at the center of these technologies that are supposed to advance justice.
Mark, how do you define forensic colonialism?
Forensic colonialism refers to the relationships between settler colonialism and international forensic genetic research and the hierarchies of racism and sovereignty within these relationships through which scientists engage in research on indigenous peoples, variously using them as research resources, and also developing these forensic genetic technologies that directly target them as, you know, at a collective or population level. So again, this is the issue around categorizing peoples around racial concepts. And by settler colonialism, I mean states like Brazil, the United States, and China that are successors to earlier empires, and in which local indigenous peoples are displaced by settlers and variously assimilated, marginalized, and frequently subject to genocide, such as the indigenous peoples of Brazil, and also the Uyghurs and other indigenous peoples in China in the contemporary, you know, at the current time.
So in your book, you discuss about the Human Genome Diversity Project. What is it?
The Human Genome Diversity Project was first proposed by Kenneth Kidd of Yale University and Lucas Cavalli-Saforza of Stanford University, who are both prominent figures in the field of population genetics. And this was in the mid-1980s. And they saw, and their other people that they were cooperating with, sought to gather as many indigenous peoples, particularly indigenous peoples, blood samples. And what they wanted to do was then gather these into a huge collection. Originally, they were targeting some 500 to 700 indigenous group, largely indigenous populations, on the premise that these people were geographically isolated and they were disappearing due to the expansion of the modern world, and that their genetic diversity would be lost to humanity. And so these scientists wanted to gather up that genetic diversity and keep it to serve humanity in perpetuity, essentially putting them in a state of genetic servitude. The project itself, once it was publicly announced in the early 1990s, was sharply criticized by indigenous organizations and activists as the Vampire Project and biocolonialism. And these activists and their other social justice organizations began organizing in an early effort using the internet from 1993 onwards, and they were very successful. The project was effectively shelved by the late 1990s, and only a small collection now is still being used. But this collection is of about 1,063 what are called cell lines, are still sitting in a Paris suburb and being used in the development of various genetic technologies, essentially functioning as what the involved scientists call a resource. Now, the way they've done this, one of the goals of the Human Genome Diversity Project was to take these blood samples and then to quickly get them into a lab where they could go through a process called immortalization. Now, immortalization involves infecting the blood sample with a virus called Epstein-Barr virus, which is part of the herpes virus family. But this, when these blood samples are infected with this Epstein-Barr virus, it has an important effect in that it turns off what is called cell apoptosis or cell death. And this allows the virally transformed blood samples to be grown in laboratories indefinitely. So unlimited amounts of genetic materials can be grown from this, from these immortalized cell, what are called cell lines. And these cell lines are still in service today. So people like the Caritiana and the Surui of Western Brazil, who were sampled in 1987, have been transformed into vital resources in the research and development and testing of these new forensic genetic technologies. So the Human Genome Diversity Project is an example of how, you know, major scientists have transformed indigenous peoples into important resources. And this is very problematic, has been widely criticized in the fields of genetic research and also in indigenous rights issues.
Rightfully so, indeed. So in your book, you also discuss the concept of genetics as intelligence. How did the war on terror after 9/11 shape this concept?
Well, intelligence can be defined as information that helps guide police investigation and manhunts and also security agency activities. Concepts of intelligence-led policing date back to the 1970s and 80s. And after the 9/11 attacks, such ideas were fused with the war on terror. And in particular, there's been a concern about how to identify unknown suspects using genetics who might not be in any database. For example, the FBI has a database along with now with the Homeland Security with involving millions of different genetic profiles. But if these profiles are of an unknown suspect whose profile is not in those sorts of databases is found, this raised the question then for the security agencies and policing, well, what do we do then? So after 9/11, citing these serious difficulties, the Bush administration began its $1 billion President's DNA initiative. And this program was run by the U.S. Department of Justice and provided extensive funding for what was termed alternative genetic markers and assays, genetic tests. I'll continue the quote here, that can potentially provide further information about biological samples under investigation, such as estimation of ethnic origins, physical characteristics, and skin color. So prior to 9/11, such efforts had been taboo due to the racist connotations. But after 9/11, this expansion into what these racialized categories was allowed and encouraged and given a lot of money. And so what happened after 9/11 is we get a number of teams around the world, research teams in the US, Europe, and China began research on ancestry and phenotype inference technologies. As such as by the early 2010s, the resulting technologies began to become commercialized. These efforts included Kenneth Kidd of Yale University, who developed a set of 55 ancestry inference markers, which are today, which by 2015 were being incorporated into Illumina and Thermo Fisher forensic genetic systems that were then being marketed to police and security agencies in the US, the European Union, China, and elsewhere. As well, by the early 2010s, we also have efforts to in phenotyping, such as a European Union-funded effort that included a 2011 patent application by Manfred Kayser and Leo Fan of Erasmus University in the Netherlands on eye color among European populations. So what we get is a series of efforts that seek after 9/11 that seek to expand the scope of genetic research into what had once been kind of taboo areas of research around race, particularly overt race, racial categories like ancestry and also visible appearance.
And of course, another very controversial topic is to do with the genetic testing and data collection in the Xinjiang area. Could you expand on this?
Yes. The implications of this type of genetic testing are very problematic. We should consider the larger research context. Since the late 2000s, the Chinese government's security apparatus has viewed the Uyghurs as potential threats particularly after 2009 clashes between Han Chinese and Uyghurs in the Xinjiang provincial capital of Urumqi, which left around 200 people dead and many more injured. And we see very quickly a strong interest by the Ministry of Public Security's Institute of Forensic Science in identifying Uyghurs and in also particularly in ancestry research. So in 2010, they filed the first of a series of 12 Chinese patent applications on ancestry inference marker technologies, with several of these expressly targeting Uyghurs and or Tibetans. And this targeting of Uyghurs is also evident in the rapid increase in the numbers of Uyghur test subjects. For example, a 2012 paper included only around 40 Uyghur subjects. However, once this crackdown intensified in 2013-2014 under the then new leader Xi Jinping, we saw a rapid increase in the numbers of Uyghurs and other Xinjiang peoples in the Institute of Forensic Sciences research papers, such as a 2016 article that included 939 Uyghurs. And so this is part of a larger pattern of targeting of the Uyghurs that began again in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And so there's a number of problems here.
And then the Visigen Consortium was found.
Okay, the Visigen Consortium is a project that began in the late 2000s as well, about 2009. And it involves prominent researchers from projects like the Twins UK, which is a well-known genetics research, long-term research project, the Rotterdam study, and also researchers from Australia and the Netherlands, and also Latin America as well. And what we have here is this group of researchers beginning a series of large projects. By 2016, they had begun cooperation with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, Max Planck Society Partner Institute of Computational Biology in Shanghai. Now, this the Institute of Partner Institute of Computational Biology in Shanghai had begun its own project involving Uyghurs and Han Chinese in about 2009. This is when it was first proposed. Originally, it was supposed to be a study of facial shape and how this shifted due to evolutionary forces. But as typical, we see this co-option of health or evolutionary research into forensic genetics. And so by 2012, the Partner Institute of Computational Biology researchers were proposing to use this in forensic genetics. And by 2014 to 2016, they began cooperation on phenotyping research targeting Uyghurs with the Chinese Ministry of Public Security's Institute of Forensic Science, effectively co-opting this evolutionary research on facial shape into the development of manhunting technologies that targeted Uyghurs. And it's also in this 2014 to 2016 period that the Visigen Consortium begins cooperation with this partner institute in Shanghai. So what we have is a situation where the Visigen Consortium is cooperating with Chinese researchers at, very important institutes in China. And then these same researchers in China are then cooperating with the Institute of Forensic Science of the Ministry of Public Security in Beijing. Another important researcher involved, a pivotal figure in some of this Visigen projects is a researcher named Liu Fan. And he studied at Erasmus University with Manfred Kayser of Erasmus University, who's an eminent researcher in forensic genetics. And he'd worked in a joint position at Erasmus University. In 2015, Liu Fan was appointed to the Beijing Institute of Genomics in Beijing. And this is, again, a high-profile institute. And in the same year, 2015, the Beijing Institute of Genomics began a joint research center with the Ministry of Public Security's Institute of Forensic Science, which continues to do joint research. And so what we get here are a set of relationships that are helping to develop the ability of the Chinese Ministry of Public Security's Institute of Forensic Science in its efforts to develop phenotyping technologies that target Uyghurs.
So given the sensitivity and the seriousness of the ethical implications surrounding genotyping and ancestry estimation, how do you see the future of population and forensic genetics?
I think until recently, debates over population research and evolutionary research being co-opted into forensic genetics have not really attracted much attention. My hope is now that with the attention paid to the Uyghur issues, that this will serve some good in provoking a sustained critical debate and also supportive legislation over the role of racial categories and classifications in forensic genetics. There is a very strong resistance, however, amongst many scientists to such oversight. Many of them still view it as an intrusion, and that they are capable of their own ethical self-regulation. But I think this is the issues raised by this extensive cooperation during the 2010s targeting Uyghurs, and also the longer-term issues of routine violations of Indigenous peoples' rights and dignity through the use of genetic samples taken 20 and 30, even almost 50 years ago now, in the case of the Ticuna of Western Brazil. Their samples were taken in 1976. This is raising a lot of major issues, and I think that there has to be a much stronger public debate and scrutiny over the way in which forensic genetics has been developed and the way it is also being implemented. I think many thousands of people, for example, who have contributed samples to the Visigen consortium, you know, people from the Twins UK project and also from the Rotterdam study, among others, would be very concerned to know that their genetics are being used or have been used, in the past in research in conjunction with, you know, nearly 700 Uyghurs from the Xinjiang Uyghur study to create technologies, you know, phenotyping technologies, which are going to be used to hunt people, track them down, and as opposed to sort of health research. And this is, again, a major issue is there's a co-option of long-term health research projects and also of evolutionary genetic research in the name of public security into the development of these new technologies using what were once discredited concepts of race. And this is a very problematic, and frankly, there's an underlying racism in the way in which this has been conducted. And it's all done again in the name of public security and improving safety. Yet what we see is mass violations of Indigenous people's rights and dignity, violation of their sovereignty, violation of international norms such as the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, Section 31, which expressly says that Indigenous people should have a direct role in any research involving them. It has violated contemporary codes on secondary usages of genetic samples and data. And so what we see is a series of hierarchies of power being enacted that I think are very worrisome, given the state of forensic genetics and how rapidly it is advancing, how it is now being implemented, and how it is receiving massive amounts of funding from various governments such as the US, the European Union, and China. So I'm very concerned about the future of this research because of its very problematic history, whether that be the use of these samples taken from indigenous peoples decades ago to the contemporary way in, you know, in recent years, the way in which Uyghurs have been specifically targeted and the way in which many researchers refuse to acknowledge ethical wrongdoing. And I think this is a major problem, or a series of major problems, actually.
It is indeed a very stimulating and thought-provoking discussion, especially for me as a scientist. So thank you very much for all this talk. So what are you currently working on? What's your next project?
I'm working on the way in which forensic genetics makes use of different types of categories using concepts around synecdoche and metonymy. And so I want to understand how these function in scientific organizing narratives, how scientists organize themselves. Furthermore, I'm beginning research projects on the U.S. military's use of forensic genetics and also the use of genetic selection of its elite special forces. This is a very worrisome development as well. So what we see is, again, the development of further technologies with further ethical problems. And I guess this will be the next few years anyways.
Mark, many thanks for joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for your interest in my book.